NPR's business news starts with lower oil prices. Oil prices continue to drop today. Prices have fallen below $100 a barrel, sharply lower than the $115 we've seen in recent weeks. Traders are selling, in part out of concern that high gas prices in the U.S. will lead to a drop in fuel consumption. That struggling car maker Saab may get a lifeline from a Chinese car company. Saab was owned by General Motors. GM sold Saab to a Dutch company last year as part of GM's restructuring process. The company has had trouble turning Saab around, so now it's turned to China for help. Today it announced a deal with China's largest car distributor. It's called Pengda. In a deal worth about $90 million, the Chinese company will take a 24% stake in Saab's parent company. As we just heard, students face huge challenges in managing debt. In the U.S., student loan debt surpassed credit card debt last year. This year, it's projected to exceed $1 trillion. Steve Inskeep spoke with Mark Kantrowitz, as publisher of FinAid.org and FastWeb.com. He writes about the choices students need to make before they enter college.
So is all of this borrowing for college smart?
Well, it's smart if it's enabling you to invest in your future. It's not smart if you're overborrowing for the value of that investment.
Overborrowing? So
if you borrow more than your expected starting salary after you graduate, you're going to struggle to repay your loans. And I can see someone borrowing perhaps $10,000 a year if they're majoring in computer science or nursing, but I can't see borrowing that amount of money for a degree in art or humanities or sociology, because the jobs just don't pay as well for those fields of study.
What are some of the most, let's say, the hardest degrees to monetize later on?
Some of the most common majors for students who are having trouble are degrees in religious studies, in theater. Ethnomusicology is one that I've written about, where I got a call and an email from a student who was contemplating borrowing six figures of debt to pay for that degree.
Ethnomusicology. I mean, that's the study of music, but also of the society behind, the culture behind the music. Is that right?
That's right. And there are only two main occupations for a degree in ethnomusicology. One is being a music librarian, which doesn't pay very well. The other is being a university faculty teaching other students about ethnomusicology.
If you're having to borrow that $10,000 per year, you got to multiply that by 4 years, maybe more. You should hope that the field that you're heading into has a starting salary of at least that much.
That's right. And if you're going to be borrowing more than that, you should look for a less expensive college. Or maybe you should double major in a field that will enable you to repay that debt.
So you're not saying don't become an ethnomusicologist. You are saying do it in a smart way so that you don't get in trouble later on.
That's right. I'd be the last person to tell a student not to follow their dreams. You just need to have that kind of conversation before you incur the debt.
Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of FinAid.org and FastWeb.com. He's speaking from member station WQED in Pittsburgh. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
And our series Money Counts continues all week. We'll hear about a program in Virginia that teaches middle school students the value of a buck. There's more on our series at our website, npr.org.
Many young adults get their first taste for history through fiction. But beware, many of those great details that can pull a young reader into a historical novel are often only that, fictional details, not facts, by a long shot. That was the case for author and historian Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman. For our series, You Must Read This, she recommends an author whose work may be questionable history, but great reading.
They always had men on the front cover. Tall, handsome, rugged men, looking towards the burnt Sienna buttes of Colorado or New Mexico. My Uncle Thaddeus kept two stacks on the dinged-up coffee table and another on the laminated kitchen dinette. Sometimes I'd slip my hand behind the recliner cushion and find one that had slipped down the back. My uncle never knew, but when I was about 12, I read every Louis L'Amour novel I could find in his little tract house in El Cajon, California. We lived over the mountain and drove into town on weekends so the grown-ups could play pinochle. We called our cousins city slickers because they wore shoes all the time, even in the house. It seemed a sorry habit until we saw the grimy sidewalks. Give me clean dirt anytime. But it was in suburbia that I found the West. I grew up with the Sacketts, that clan of laconic gunslingers with a dry sense of humor who killed a man only when he needed it. L'Amour's characters gave Zeitgeist a Western twang. No Sackett was ever much on the brag, Tell says. We want folks to leave us alone, and we leave them alone. But when fighting comes, we stand ready. The Sackett brothers were shy around women, but I knew I could put them at ease. I would make them pie and show them round the ranch. My blanket roll and mess kit could be ready in 10 minutes. When I became a historian, chock full of postmodern theories on subalterns and the other, I realized that Louis L'Amour would never find his way into footnotes. Cowboys and Indians, not usually enemies in L'Amour's novels, were now. And don't even mention senoritas, or we'll be on about the feminization of Mexico all night. It wasn't simply that Louis L'Amour was a dime store novelist. He wrote about a West that no longer existed even in history books. I branched out. I read Larry McMurtry, who took higher aim. I read Max Brand. I tried, really. But some Americana is not to be missed. For a glimpse into the beating heart of the West, you must read Louis L'Amour. I'm already saddled up.
Elizabeth Cobbs Hoffman is the author of Broken Promises, a novel of the Civil War. If you want to discuss books with other NPR listeners, you can join the NPR Facebook community. Just search for NPR Books and click Like. And you can find the complete list of You Must Read This recommendations at npr.org. Scientists aren't just taking living things into space. For more than 50 years, they've been looking for life that might already be there. That effort is now running short of money, as Amy Standen of member station KQED reports.
It takes a certain type of person to devote an entire career to chasing something she'll probably never find. One such person is Jill Tarter.
I'm the director of the Center for SETI Research at the SETI Institute in Mountain View, California.
SETI stands for Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Mountain View is a long way from Hollywood. There, Jill Tarter's life was given a very different arc, at least as portrayed by Jodie Foster in the 1997 film Contact. In this scene, Ellie Arroway, Foster's character, hears the unmistakable signature of extraterrestrial intelligence over her headphones.
Is anybody awake in there? I'm moving the array! Confirm!
Boss has a bogey!
In real life, of course, the search has been a lot quieter. Tarter is in her 60s now. She wears her gray hair in a short, no-nonsense cut. She's been working on this for more than 40 years.
I don't know whether anyone ever will find a signal. I certainly don't know whether I will.
Back when Tarter started at the SETI Institute, the project received funding from NASA, but that support ended in 1993. Since then, she and others have spent almost as much time searching for money as they have searching for ET. Then, 3 years ago, the SETI Institute marked what felt like a turning point, the opening of the Allen Telescope Array, a field of 20-foot-wide radio telescopes in California's rural Hat Creek Valley, funded by Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen. Thanks to this Allen Telescope Array, which is jointly managed with the University of California, Berkeley, SETI scientists could scan the skies full-time, hoping a clear, telltale radio signal would stand out from the universe's background hiss.
We're looking for signals that are compressed in frequency, because nature doesn't do that. Technology does.
Now, to understand SETI, you have to understand this, that we humans are a very young species on a very young planet, and we've only had modern technology for the last couple hundred years. Tarter says it's a cosmic blip.
Our galaxy is 10 billion years old, and most of the stars in our region of the galaxy are about a billion years older than our sun.
In this broader scope of cosmic time, we humans are practically newborns.
We don't know if there are any other technologies out there, but if there are, we can be pretty sure they're older and more capable than we are.
Capable, she hopes, of beaming high-power radio waves that our telescopes could eventually pick up. But this is a long shot, perhaps the longest long shot in science, says Caleb Scharf, director of astrobiology at Columbia University.
All of those arguments ultimately rest on big
big assumptions that tend to be very human-centric.
For instance, that another civilization would use radio signals at all, or would have any interest in finding us. And then there's the problem of timing.
Even if there were many, many technological civilizations in our galaxy, the chances of one of them being radio loud,
that is, broadcasting a loud radio signal,
right at this instant, right at the time that we have the right technology to listen for it, the odds seems to shrink a lot.
But recently something happened that gave those odds a modest boost.
Engine start, 1-0, and liftoff of the Delta II rocket with Kepler on a search for planets in some way like our own.
NASA's Kepler telescope found signs of what it was looking for, dozens of possible planets that might be similar to Earth, orbiting distant stars like our sun.
Some of these are potentially habitable planets.
Dimitar Sasilov is on the Kepler team. He also directs Harvard's Origins of Life initiative.
This is where we should be looking for the signals coming from other civilizations to start with. SETI is already in possession of that list.
But as of April, the SETI Institute has had to file that list away indefinitely. That's because California's budget is in crisis. Facing a $26 billion deficit, the state has made major cuts across the public university system. UC Berkeley says it can no longer afford to operate the Allen Array. The project is officially in hibernation. Jill Tarter says she's frustrated by the holdup.
Never before have we known such good potential targets at which to point our telescopes. And that's what we want to do.
Tarter wants to raise $5 million in private money to search the Kepler planets. Caleb Scharf, the Columbia astrobiologist we heard from earlier, says he thinks that's a bargain. Sure, SETI's a long shot, but science needs long shots.
Too often in modern science, we kind of narrow down our vision. We narrow down what we want to look at a little too much.
SETI, on the other hand, swings for the fences. The money may never pay off, says Scharf, but we'll never know unless we try.
I think the best argument for SETI is simply that we do not know. The only real solution is to look, and to look in as broad a way as you can.
Jill Tarter, for her part, says she knows she probably won't find ET in her lifetime. To find SETI a reliable source of funding, that would be achievement enough. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And if you turn on a TV talk show, it can seem like everyone in America is getting counseling. But how does one find help that's right for you? NPR's Nancy Shute reports on why it can be difficult to find good psychotherapy.
Scientists have put a lot of effort into testing psychotherapy to see if it really works. As a result, they now have solid evidence on therapy for common mental problems. But Alan Kasdan, a clinical psychologist and director of the Yale Parenting Center, says you can't always find it.
And in fact, we have very effective treatments for all sorts of things, and to try to get one of them if you have a problem is very difficult.
In fact, there have been thousands of randomized clinical trials done on psychotherapy. They've found behavioral interventions that work just as well as drugs and with no side effects. One of the great success stories is cognitive behavioral therapy. It teaches people to replace negative thoughts about problems in everyday life.
Cognitive therapy for depression is one of the most widely studied treatments. It has evidence going back to the late 70s and much more evidence in more recent years. It's a treatment of choice for psychotherapy for depression.
And there are dozens of other good therapies for mental health problems. Kasdan is part of a movement to make those treatments part of all psychotherapy. But that movement is having a hard time gaining traction. And Kasdan's really not happy about that.
It would be like, you know, having grape juice to control your cancer when, in fact, there's chemotherapy.
So if you or a family member need mental health therapy, it's time to become a savvy shopper. Kasdan explains how.
You interview therapists, or you, if you're not incapable of doing that because of some crisis, you have a relative help you. And among the questions would be the obvious ones. What do you do when you see patients like me or like my spouse or my sister? And what is the evidence for that treatment? And then is there anything I could read about that? And then I would go home and look all this up.
There's also lots of information online about therapy that's been tested. And we've got a list for you at NPR.org, too. But when you're suffering, it can be hard to shop. That's what happened to Janet Olson. 3 years ago, she was doing triathlons. Then she started losing control.
So things spiraled down quickly and ended up in the ER about three times for craziness, sort of manic symptoms, running off into the woods and hiding and, you know, it's just insane.
She was diagnosed with depression, anxiety, and eventually bipolar disorder. She went to a psychiatrist for medication, but her doctor also recommended talk therapy. Janet lives in a small town in upstate New York where there aren't too many healthcare choices. So she did another thing that people can do. She asked a friend who's a clinical social worker for advice.
Fortunately, I have a very good friend, and she had recommended a therapist that she had worked with. It was perfect.
That therapist practices psychodynamic therapy, which has been shown to help with depression. As far as she's concerned, Olson said that therapy has been a huge factor in her recovery.
My psychologist is just wonderful, and she helps me from minimizing my actions and my tendencies to neglect my health and well-being no matter what it might be.
There are still lots of therapists who haven't adopted proven therapies. Some fear that this push for science-based techniques will make it harder for them to connect with clients on a human level. Scott Lilienfeld disagrees. He's a clinical psychologist at Emory University. He says good therapy has room for both science and a human touch.
Part of the role of a good psychotherapist is persuasion, is getting people to understand why they should change.
Janet Olson knows she's changed, and for the better. At age 54, she's training for triathlons again, and she's coaching other women, too. Nancy Shute, NPR News.
As American society has changed, the face of TV news has slowly caught up with it. Two women have been anchoring the nation's three most prominent evening news shows, and the country's racial and ethnic diversity is reflected as well. Yet as NPR's David Folkenflik reports, there is one way in which TV anchors live in a very different world.
CNN's Don Lemon is on TV a lot. He is the network's weekend primetime anchor, but you've never heard him say what he's about to say. And Lemon says he's been advised not to.
Do I want to be the gay anchor? Which is what my mentors in the business, my agents, the people I respect said, do you want to always be labeled as the gay anchor? And I'd have to say at this point, why the hell not?
Don Lemon is 45. He's from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, an African-American raised Southern Baptist who attended Catholic schools, went to Brooklyn College, and prospered in the competitive world of TV news. Oh, and he's gay. As a kid, Lemon says he knew he was different, but kept hearing the call in church to
pray the gay away.
Colleagues at work do know about his 4-year relationship with his boyfriend, a CNN producer. But until now, Lemon has been extremely guarded with the public. He was told anchors do not talk about such things.
We live and die by people watching us. If I give people another reason not to watch me, that is a concern for me, and that's a concern for whoever I am working for. My livelihood is on the line. I don't know if people are going to accept me. I don't know if I'll have a job. I don't know how people are going to feel about this.
Lemon spoke with NPR ahead of the release of his memoir, Transparent, in which he talks about his upbringing, his discovery of who his true father was, and about the sexual abuse he suffered as a child. Lemon first disclosed that on CNN last fall during an interview about a prominent minister accused of abuse.
Let me only tell you what got my attention about this, and I've never admitted this on television. I am a victim of a pedophile when I was a kid.
Lemon was writing his memoir at the time. He says it was cathartic to release secrets he had been holding so tight. And yet Lemon says he was scared, is scared, that he will pay a price.
Most people would think, if you're the prime news anchor, then you should sort of be this Edward R. Murrow kind of Clark Kent kind of guy with the family and the 2.5 kids, or the perky, cute, yet smart Katie Couric. Anyone would have to be naive to think that it wouldn't make a difference.
In some ways, our conversation felt oddly retro. After all, Americans say they are accepting of homosexuality by nearly a 2-to-1 margin. The Defense Department is lifting the ban on gays in the military. Former Vice President Dick Cheney, hardly a liberal, has embraced the idea of gay marriage. I asked Lemon, surely his own mentors don't think being gay is a negative in this day and age.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Okay.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Look around, Lemon says. There are no openly gay U.S. senators or Supreme Court justices. No one who's gay in the NFL or the NBA. Few top-paid openly gay or lesbian Hollywood stars. And there are almost no openly gay leading news anchors or correspondents in TV news. Former ABC News President David Westin.
When you're talking about particularly on-air personalities, and this is a problem with these jobs, you'd be shocked at what you talk about. You talk about hairstyles, you talk about accents. So you talk about everything. And so among those things, yeah, we would talk from time to time about the question of sexual orientation and whether it would make a difference.
He said executives concluded being gay was not disqualifying for an anchor, but that some viewers would turn away. TV news ratings, after all, are dropping, and there's a lot of money at stake. Millions for top anchors and hundreds of millions for top news outlets.
When you have that fine a margin and you're fighting for every little bit competitive edge you can, then it's understandable that people would be afraid of the unknown. I personally think we will get through there and we'll look back and say, what was the big deal? I think. But until you've done it, you haven't done it.
Westin says he believes, he hopes, attitudes have become more accepting. But as he says, it's the great unknown. A lot of news stories involve sexual orientation, gays in the military, ordination of gay clergy, gay marriage. Lemon says he's concerned some viewers may not accept hearing about such stories from someone whom they know to be gay. Though, as Lemon notes, heterosexual anchors, regardless of their private lives or private views, don't have that problem.
It may not be a year. It could be 5 years or it could be 10 years. But this revelation about my sexuality will end up being on the pro side of the column rather than the con side of the column. And so be it. If in this broadcast industry, the way it works now, that I can't be the anchor man, then my career will transform into something else.
David Folkenflik, NPR News.